You may examine.
Dr. Gunderson, did Dr. Zarnik know that you were working on the 768 decoding experiment?
Yeah, I mean, it was a collaborative experiment between chemistry and molecular biology, so yeah, of course he knew.
Did Dr. Zarnik ever come to you with any concerns about the way the 768 decoding experiment was being run?
Not myself, personally. He didn't come to me.
Let's go back to Trial Exhibit 269, please. I believe Mr. Pantone questioned you about this two-color...
Do you want to go to the slide?
Right there is fine. Where it says we've now tested two different sets of 768, and with both, okay, showing, both showing good specificity. I think the letter S is missing. So I think you said you didn't know what Dr. Chi was referring to in this email message. Is that correct?
I can't... No, at this point, I don't know what he was referring to.
Okay. Well, let's step back a little bit and talk about... I think you mentioned screening exercises that were at issue with the 768 decoding experiment. What did you mean by screening?
Well, the 768 experiment. One of the purposes, well, original purposes, we were supposed to develop 2,000 good sequences for our collaboration with Applied Biosystems. That was established late fall of 1999, I believe, and our plan was to screen sequences experimentally, test them in sets of 768. The reason for that magic number, 768, is we have an instrument in our lab called an oligator that synthesizes or makes these short snips of DNA in batches of 768. So it was reasonable to screen them in batches of 768. So that's why all experiments were conducted on the 768 size scale. And the goal was to screen various sets of 768 until we'd accumulated 2,000 sequences that we called good, that passed various criteria. We wanted them to hybridize really well in, well, when we sell the product to people, basically.
So you are saying you were trying to select out 2,000 really good sequences, well-behaved sequences.
That's right. We generated over 4,000 potential sequences, and we wanted to functionally screen them to get down to 2,000 good sequences.
I think with Mr. Pantone questioning you, then you said that the June-July 768 experiment was the second experiment that you had conducted with the set of 768 sequences, correct?
That's right. There was an earlier one where we didn't get a lot of data from it. That was also done with a different set of sequences that we weren't going to mix with this set. There was some business reasons for going to a different set, completely independent of the first set.
Okay. And I think you've also mentioned that the decoding experiments were really a team effort. Let me show you what's one of our demonstrative exhibits, if you could. Now, Dr. Gunderson, have you seen this poster before?
That's right.
And did you help create this poster?
Yes.
And we will put it on the big screen as well. Maybe if you come down here, you can just point to it.
Okay.
So, can you describe for the jury how the 768 decoding experiment was a team effort?
Yeah. This poster board depicts the organization of basically our screening experiments. And these 768 experiments were going to be done again and again until we had 2,000 good sequences. And sequences were going to be synthesized or created by the oligator. It's called oligosynthesis. These are these little pieces of DNA that we put on beads. And we need these pieces of DNA both for the beads themselves to put on the beads. And then we put their cognate sequence into decoding labeling. I was responsible for actually making the decoders, myself and Jim Beerley and Monica Maluski. Having worked for me, we were responsible for making the decoders, pulling them, and then actually conducting the arrays and hybridization experiment. And engineering was responsible for image processing. And they were under Richard Podolewski and Bob Kane. They actually made the instrument to read the arrays and then note some of the software to process the images. And data analysis was done by Baram in bioinformatics. The beads for the arrays were made by chemistry, and that was originally headed by Tony Zarnik. And Steve Barnard and Chanfeng Zhao worked under him to make the beads. Basically, the beads and decoder come together in the decoding process.
I think Mr. Pantone also questioned you on whether or not you discussed using two colors versus three colors with Mark Chi. I think you said two colors was a fallback position. Where did you make that up?
If three colors didn't work and four colors didn't work, we could fall back on two colors. We'd been doing two colors since the start of the company. It was easy, it works. So, however, as you want to decode more and more bead types, it requires more and more stages. We used three-color decoding, which required something called seven stages, which maybe we'll get to, whereas two-color would require 11 stages. It was a lot more effort to use two colors, so that's why we tried to use three colors.
So is it fair to say the more colors you used, the fewer steps you have to go through to decode an array?
Correct.
Maybe now is a good time, then, to talk about... I believe you said in November 1998 you did a 16-bead decoding experiment. Is that correct?
That's correct. Should I stand here or sit down?
Yeah, I think you can go back on the witness stand. Why don't we put up another demonstrative exhibit so we can kind of walk through that to go through the concept of all the decoding. We will take this down now. Do you have that on the display?
Which one do you want?
It's this. Okay. Is this actually one of your 16-bead decoding experiments?
That's correct. That's a real experiment.
How many colors in this experiment?
Hey, it's upside down.
That's a four-color experiment.
It is upside down. Would you read the number on the back, please?
Trial Exhibit 344-3, marked for ID, 344-3, 16-bead array experiment. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay. So can you sort of walk the jurors through how you would decode a 16-bead array?
Yeah. Maybe I'll come down there and make it easier. So, like I had mentioned previously, DNA arrays are made out of DNA, and DNA has its property called hybridization. Two strands of DNA will come together and hybridize. Hybridization is very specific, and the partner of a DNA strand will recognize its specific partner. So, like I say, we attach pieces of DNA to the beads, and then we put its partner in solution and label it. And when we bring those two together, the labeled partner will find its correct bead type. So the way we do decoding is we make an array with 16 different bead types. Now, mind you, this array can have thousands of beads, but there's only 16 bead types. So each bead type is represented numerous times. Now, the way we do decoding, originally this is black. Everything is black, right? They just have a piece of DNA on them. There's no color. However, we make its partner colored by attaching a label to it. And we create what we call a decoding mix. And if you're going to decode 16 bead types with this scheme, we have 16 partners. So we have a complete set of partners. Each bead type has a partner in the decoding mix. And we color those partners with the particular scheme. That allows us to infer information about the bead types. So, in this example, the first decode mix, we color the first four partners blue, the second four are green, third four yellow, and the last four are red. And then we expose the array to this mix, and it colors the beads. The first four bead types get colored blue because hybridization is very specific and finds its unique partner. The second set gets colored green, third set yellow, and the fourth set red. So after one decode step, we looked at the image. And if it's a red bead, now you've gained some information. Previously, it could be one of 16 beads, but if it's red now, it's one of four beads. Now you still haven't narrowed it down to the exact bead type, so what you do is add a second decode step.
Dr. Gunderson, so do you wash off the first set of decoders?
Yeah, hybridization, or DNA, has this property of hybridization. And You can also dehybridize quite readily just by exposing it to heat or alkaline solution like sodium hydroxide found in your drain cleaner. That will cause DNA to dehybridize and come apart. That's what we do, dehybridize it, take all the color away, and sort of repaint the beads with a second decoder solution. And in the second solution, we have all 16 partners there, but we color them differently. And you can see the way we color them. So originally, the first four bead types will be colored blue. Now we construct the color such that that blue set is split among the four colors as shown, blue, green, yellow, red, and then we split the second set of colors four ways again, and four ways, and four ways. So in two stages, we can ascribe a unique color signature to each bead type. Bead type 1 should be blue in the first stage, blue in the second stage, and so on. And if we actually look at the images from the two stages, we can look at this bead here. Again, these are images, so you see the same beads in both images.
That's the same array with two different pictures.
That same array, but taken at two different times, one after the first decode hybridization, this one after the second decode hybridization. This bead here is blue in the first, red in the second. That's a unique signature. Blue-red, that means it's bead type 4. This bead type here is, you can see, it's yellow, and then it's blue, and that's bead type 9. You know, this one here is red and then blue. We look up red-blue, you get a unique signature. It's bead type 13. That's basically how we do our decoding. So this is 16 bead types we've decoded over two stages because we're using four colors. You get a power of 4 with each stage. With one stage, we can decode 4 bead types because we have 4 colors. With two stages, we can decode 16 bead types because we can split it 4 ways each time. If we have 3 stages, you get 4 times 4 times 4, which is 64. 4 stages is, what, 256. 5 stages is 1,000-some, and 6 stages is 4,000-some bead types. So a sixth stage decode would give you 6 colors. Each bead type would have a signature with 6 colors. So that's basically how we do the decoding.
So going back to the summer of 2000 when you were doing a 768 decoding experiment with 3 colors.
That's right.
You needed more of the different sets of decoder pools, correct? More stages.
That's right. With 3 colors, we needed 7 stages to assign a unique color signature to each bead type.
Okay. I think you did. You weren't here, but Dr. Chi did a little demonstration there with the dyes. So preparing the decoder pools for the 768 experiment, how many of those small vials of dye did you actually have to go through to properly make all the decoder pools?
Actually, I have an overhead that shows that too.
How about if we could put up the demonstratives?
Because we were labeling 768 at a time, and molecular probes supplied the dye in real small vials. I think I have my example of the vials right here. Basically, we buy these dye vials from the vendor. They're a small vial, and they're dark, so you can't really see into them. We combined 11 of these vials for each labeling reaction. We combine 11 blue vials, 11 green vials, 11 red vials, and so on. That's how we did our labeling. Made one big master pool of dye and labeled them.
Who actually did the labeling chemistry part of the 768 experiment?
The actual labeling was conducted by Jim Beerley and Monica Maluski.
How long did that take?
The actual labeling part of the experiments took a matter, I think, with all the dyes we used, took a matter of a week. That's labeling, purification, and so forth.
So will you put those up?
Mm-hmm.
And the next one? Just the ones with the decoder.
This just shows you denaturation and renaturation, that DNA can come together and come apart.
Kevin, we are just going to jump ahead.
That's the basic dogma of the cell. Find DNA in the nucleus organized in the chromosomes. That's made out of base pairs, A, T, C, G.
Due to the time constraints we have, we're going to have to skip through some of the jury slides. Sorry. Let's go to number 8 of this exhibit. Okay. So what does this 15-8 illustrate?
This is a basic cartoon illustration of how we generated the master mixes for the die. So for three colors here, we were combining 11 of these little amber vials into one tube and then use that to label the oligos.
Actually, I don't think the color reproduces well when it's projected, but...
Actually, the color is completely obliterated in this projection, so it doesn't illustrate the point that I want.
Okay, let's go to the next one.
But basically, there was three dyes used, a blue, green, and red. And it was the green dye that had some vials that were mislabeled, so it was contaminated with some of the incorrect dye.
Yes, I think Dr. Chi demonstrated that with the bottles.
That's right.
So what does this illustrate?
This illustrates the way we actually labeled these oligos. So we got the oligos from the Oligo Lab, the Oligator Lab, and they come in 96 wall plates. That's the way the machine synthesizes or makes these oligos, makes them in these standards, microtiter parts. With 96 walls, it's industry standard. We'll take one plate. This is plate one. We actually have 8 plates. Plate 1 gets split into 3 what we call daughter plates. Plate 1 gets split into 3 what we call daughter plates. The given oligo just gets distributed among the different plates. The plates are replicants of each other. They contain all the same oligos. And then we just label each plate with a different dye. For plate 1, we split it into plate 1, blue dye, and plate 1, green dye, and plate 1, red dye. And, of course, before we label them, we purify them, because you have to purify them away from some impurities that would inhibit the labeling reaction. After labeling, we also purify them again. We pool the dyes. We pool them into a decoder solution that I illustrated on the decode illustration. So we have to pick the appropriate colors and mix them together in such a way that we assign a unique signature to each bead type when we do a decoder hybridization.
And the next slide, dash 10, please. What does this illustrate?
This illustrates one way in which you may create, like, a stage 1 decoder pool for just the first plate. So the first plate will decode 768 oligos right there, the partners to 96 bead types on the RNA. You might take the first type of plate 1 and use it to color the beads blue, and the second third of the plate, shown in the middle there, colored green. You combine that with the last of the plate colored red, so you would have blue, green, and red. And those 96 bead types, the first third colored blue, second third green, and the last third red. And that's the first 96 going into the decode pool. Then you would do a similar treatment for the next 7 plates. It would be 7 times 3 being 21 plates. But
so a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. There's a lot of labeling. For 4 colors, you have to label over 3,000 different oligos.
So these are the reagents you referred to that you had to prepare in order to actually conduct the actual decoding part of the experiment.
We had to label these, purify them, and pool them.
So when you saw the letter from Molecular Probes saying some of the dye were mislabeled, is that good news or bad news?
Well, naturally, it's bad news. Just the dye itself in this labeling experiment costs around $6,000, $7,000. That didn't include the labor that went into the labeling. So naturally, I was a little upset that such a mistake would occur.
Did Dr. Zarnik actually help you obtain a refund for those dyes?
Yeah, I believe Dr. Zarnik knew maybe the president of Molecular Probes, so he did obtain a nice refund for us.
Did he say anything to you about obtaining a refund?
Yeah. I passed on information to him, and he actually wrote the letters to, I forget who's the head of Molecular Probes, but yeah.
And at the time he mentioned getting the refund to you, did he ever express any concern that the data from this experiment might be used to fraudulently induce investors to buy Illumina stock?
Not at all.
Let's go back to exhibit, I believe it was 354?
Yeah.
Oh, let me ask you a question about these particular dyes that are used by molecular biologists at Illumina. Are these dyes kept under lock and key in a certain laboratory?
They are kept in a certain laboratory, but not under lock and key.
What if a chemist wanted to test whether or not the dye vials were properly labeled and wanted to conduct a quick 5-minute experiment to check if they were properly labeled? Could a chemist ask one of the molecular biologists for the labeling for that?
Yeah.
I mean, so there's no restriction on who can touch these vials?
No.
Let's go back to 354 to the section that's called summary. I think Mr. Pantone had you referred you to the first part of that paragraph.
Shaky hands, caffeine.
Okay, let's have you read the last sentence of that paragraph that starts with nonetheless.
Nonetheless, enough cluster separation existed between the three different possible bead colors to allow Bahram's decoding algorithms to decode 500 different bead types.
In terms of that sentence, did you view the results of the experiment to show that over 500 bead types could be decoded?
Yeah, they could be decoded.
But I believe Mr. Pantone questioned whether you believed you concluded that those 500 bead types were accurately decoded. Did you testify that you did not conclude that they were accurately decoded?
Well, those bead types that were decoded may have been accurately decoded, but I was really concerned about beads dropping out. How bright were the beads? In this end, these were going to go into a product. They had to be screened. They had to be bright. They had to work really well. From this data, I wasn't confident we could trust the screening data to make that selection. Yeah.
So in the end, how many of the 500 bead types that were decoded in this experiment were used further in the set of 2,000 bead types?
We only used 250 we went forward with.
Now, did you select those 250?
Basically, they were selected on ones that decoded and were bright. We really looked for brightness and intensity because that's one of the fundamental things that determines how well they decode. Poor decoding results from poor bead intensities. You know, you can't really tell what color it is because it's so dim. If they're dim in decoding, they're going to be dim in an assay, so they wouldn't be all that functional.
You are trying to pick the best of the best?
That's right.
Okay. In this lawsuit, Dr. Zarnik is contending that he was blowing the whistle on Illumina because of the dye mislabeling error. Did he ever express to you any concern that Illumina's IPO was somehow based on scientifically flawed data?
None whatsoever. I didn't hear anything from him until after months later.
And in fact, on the day of the IPO, did Dr. Zarnik seem concerned about any perpetration of fraud on the public?
No.
Object. The question calls for speculation of the witness and there's no foundation.
Sustained.
On the day of the IPO, did you see Dr. Zarnik exhibiting any concern that some fraud had been perpetrated on the public? Did you see any manifestation necessary in his behavior that he seemed concerned about fraud based on this experiment?
Same objection.
I think you could ask him to describe Dr. Zarnik's behavior, but the form of the question is objectionable.
On the day of the IPO, can you describe Dr. Zarnik's behavior with respect to the IPO?
Yeah. I mean, Dr. Zarnik sort of led the celebration. He brought in some cases, some champagne, bottles of champagne, popped them open. It was a very celebratory mood, and Dr. Zarnik led the charge in celebrating the IPO.
I think Mr. Pantone questioned you about Dr. Zarnik's professional interactions with you at Illumina. In your view, as a CSO, did he seem to have a mastery of the molecular biology aspects of Illumina's business?
No, Dr. Zarnik really didn't understand molecular biology, so it was difficult for him to contribute in that area.
Did he ever ask you about the molecular biology aspects of the 768 decoding experiment?
No.
And having worked with Dr. Chi previously at Affymetrix and having observed Dr. Zarnik at Illumina, how would you characterize the differences in their management styles?
Oh, Dr. Zarnik is very laid back, easygoing, completely hands off, you know? And Mark, in contrast, Mark T, in contrast, is very focused, you know, works hard. He's really, really sort of controls the experiments and wants to see the data all the time.
Just one second. I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you, Redirect.
Thank you, Judge.